Hello and welcome to The Rest is Education. I'm Ross Borthwick, and this week I'm joined by guest co-presenter Isabel Rich, who you've heard from recently, and also a current colleague of mine, Tom Mason. Welcome both.
Hi.
This evening we're hoping to talk a little bit about something we haven't really covered an awful lot, and that is actually outdoor learning and really learning outside of the classroom. And I thought, it's incredibly unnatural, isn't it, to just stick people in a box and leave them there for 8 hours and expect them to get the most out of that time, and then to sort of pretend that the real world doesn't exist until the end of the school day. And so I suppose this episode's looking at everything outside, and I really struggled to think of an appropriate working title for this episode, but I think, are the best lessons those taught outside of the classroom?
Yes, I want to hear more about this topic. It's something I'm really interested in. Are they the best lessons taught outside? The best, that's a very competitive adjective that's been chosen there, Ross Borthwick. Anyway, Tom Mason here is head of outdoor learning at a fantastic school that really prides itself on its offering in this area. Tom, we'd love to hear a bit more about you and how you ended up becoming a lead teacher in outdoor education.
So yeah, I've been teaching for 13 years. I started off as a geography and sports science graduate, which led me down to become a geography teacher, initially training at Edinburgh University, completing PGDE, worked in the state sector for a few years, and then entered private education in the UK. I worked my way up. I was a head of geography at two schools, one down south in England and also up here in Scotland. An opportunity arose where the current head at the school wanted to grow the outdoors, and I fancied a change. I fancied a change in a little bit of direction, a little bit of a new challenge. I feel like I'm a person, if I get stagnant or don't have a new challenge in front of me, to take the opportunity and to sort of was given the tools to grow something. And that also sort of linked into my background, where I've done various roles working in outdoor education centres in the UK, worked as a ski instructor in Canada, have a passion for climbing mountains and rock climbing and being out on locks and lakes, and just sort of the two married up quite nicely. And I have this really fortunate position where I get to retain my role as a classroom teacher and teach geography lessons all the way up to A level, but also sort of develop at the moment this programme, which is allowing pupils to do a range of activities, both on-site in the school and off-site and potentially within Europe and globally. So it's a really exciting project I'm running at the moment, and sort of seeing the growth and the passion of pupils is really exciting.
I can say with confidence as well, Tom, you're doing a fantastic job. And, you know, actually just so listeners know, Tom's currently joining this call from the Lake District, where he's on a four-day climbing course. So, you know, he definitely isn't one to sort of churn out the same stuff every year. And, you know, he's constantly looking to expand the offering, which is awesome. So, Tom, for those in other parts of the world, like we've got a huge international following, they might not be so au fait with what we mean by outdoor learning. And of course, actually, in every setting, outdoor learning might mean something different. So what, to you, to your mind, what is outdoor learning?
It's really important. So there's a historic view of outdoor education, and then there's a modern view of outdoor learning, and there's an organisation called the Institute for Outdoor Learning that exists at the moment. And they kind of phrase it as any learning that takes place outside. So be that reading your book outside in an English lesson, or counting pebbles when you're at nursery, or making shapes or measuring angles on a sports field, would all be considered outdoor learning. And that sort of that outdoor learning category also is bolstered and supported by the historic concept of outdoor education, which looks more at our adventurous activities, our canoeing, our hill walking, etc. And it's definitely this sort of Venn diagram that I see both existing and where they merge in a bit in the middle. And when I sort of talk about it to people, I always try to break it into five sections: that adventure, so environment, health and well-being, challenge, and memories and memorable experiences. And I strongly believe that not all outdoor learning needs to be adventurous, challenging, or character building. The sort of historic view that walking children up in a rain is going to sort of develop character is completely against my philosophy. But therefore, appropriate experiences at the right age, which are meaningful, and maybe only encounter two or three of those five sort of areas that I established earlier, would just really underpin my philosophy. There's no sort of research that those are the five concepts that make outdoor education. That's my sort of going around and speaking to lots of people when I took on the role, actually, that gave me those five sort of values.
That's such a clear definition, Tom. I really much more clear in my own head as to what outdoor learning is. And it's wonderfully broad, which is great. A question for me. Well, when I was a child, anecdotally, there definitely wasn't something called outdoor education on my timetable. I do remember the horrors of having to do a very muddy obstacle course where we weren't allowed to wear underwear because you got so wet and muddy. And that sort of slightly traumatized me at a delicate age. I was a very kind of sensitive little girl of 10. When did outdoor education become such a thing? Because I don't feel like it's always been on the curriculum.
So I, as the resident historian on the call, I'm just jump in here.
Yes.
So I'm actually a bit gutted that David isn't on the call, because when I left the school that we all worked at in London, he said, because I was on the drive team, the Thinking School drive team with him, I could choose a book and he would give it to me as a parting gift. And I've got it here, actually, and it's signed by all the members of the drive team. And obviously, you know, you guys can see, but our listeners won't be able to. And in the middle, it's got something you'll recognise as well. Do you recognise that?
Yes, I do.
What's that?
It's one of our values that we had from the school we worked at together, which is called showing courage. We have various habits of mind that we should all aspire to do in our lives.
David, put that in there to, you know, so that I'd be reminded of what a fantastic time I had and what a great team we were. And the book is actually Kurt Hahn, and it's Inspirational Visionary Outdoor and Experiential Educator. And it's by Nick Veers and Pete Allison. And essentially, it's a biography of this bloke called Kurt Hahn, who everyone that knows me, I absolutely adore. And he's sort of fallen off the sound waves a little bit. So I'm taking this moment to plug him. But before I do so, if you think about education as really, in this country anyway, as something which you were very fortunate to have, was very formal and was very much linked to, at first, classics and then really to vocation and getting a job. Outdoor ed didn't really feature very strongly until adults themselves began to, I suppose, enjoy being in the outdoors. And there's someone, I don't know if you've heard of him, Tom, but he's famous in the part of the world that you're currently on your climbing course at, a chap called Millikan Dalton, who is a bit of an eccentric in the 1800s. And he claimed to invent the short trousers, for instance, for walking purposes, a real character. But essentially, he, I suppose, dropped out of this professional world. I think he was an accountant and decided to go and live in a cave in the Lake District in Borrowdale every summer. And he decided, actually, being in the outdoors would be far more fun if other people were with him. And so he started leading trips, and he would advertise his dates in bus shelters and at train stations, and people would pay a few pence to join him for sections of what effectively became a bit of a pilgrimage route, I suppose, that he did every summer in the Lake District and then out in the Alps. And really, ergonomically anyway, in this country, getting out in the outdoors became really vogue, particularly for people in their 20s. Millikan was a bit of a radical in that he had trips for both men and women, which at the time was, you know, pretty shocking, the thought of these women walking around in short trousers in the company of men up in the mountains, so, or at least the hills of the Lake District. And so that sort of, I suppose, set a movement, if you like, that lots of us have forgotten about. And then back to Kurt Hahn, it wasn't until really 1924 that a school was set up with outdoor education at its heart. And Kurt Hahn established a school called Salem, Baden-Württemberg, in Germany. And he essentially put outdoor education at the heart of it. And that sort of led, without boring people too much, that led to schools like Gordonston being founded again by Kurt Hahn a decade later. So we won't go too much into the history of that, but I suppose you could ask the question, why did he bother? You know, why did it suddenly become important enough to put on the curriculum? And I suppose if we look at society through his eyes, he spotted six what he called declines of modern youth. There was the decline of fitness. He thought people were just because of modern forms of transport, the car, for instance, and steam train. He thought people were just getting really lazy and it wasn't good for them. The decline of initiative and enterprise. This excessive indulgence, he called, basically people being a spectator and watching the world rather than participating, going to watch a football match rather than actually playing football. And that, you know, we can all see that in our own society today. The third one, decline of memory and imagination. He thought people were just not really putting their brain to work and being creative, using tools to remember things rather than their own mind. Four, the decline of skill and care due to the weakened tradition of craftsmanship. So in modern speak, being consumers and not producers, and sort of moving away from the arts and crafts world into, you know, a sort of an immediate world of purchase. Five, the decline of self-discipline due to the ever-present availability of stimulants and tranquilizers. So I imagine he means narcotics, you know, drugs and alcohol and all the rest of it. And then finally, and he said, worst of all, the decline of compassion due to the unseemly haste with which modern life is conducted, or as William Temple called it, spiritual death. And that all sounds very macabre, but essentially like losing an appreciation for this beautiful world that we live in and because of the pace at which we live. And I think, again, we can empathize with that in the 21st century. But it's not all doom and gloom, because Hahn came up with four antidotes, which he put at the center of his education: physical fitness, expeditions, which I think Tom's going to talk to us a bit more about what actually is an expedition, projects involving crafts and manual skills, and finally, and this is quite interesting, rescue, to provide a rescue service. In other words, to serve someone else, a community and other people. There we have it. That's the introduction of outdoor ed, if you like, onto the first curriculum, as I say, at Salem and then Gordonstoun.
Wow, that's a fascinating historical tour of how it all began. And I've now got pictures of these men and women 100 years ago in rather kind of poofy shorts and shirts, sort of doing limbering up exercises before they had a brisk walk up the hill. Tom, I can sort of picture this. And actually, when you listen to Ross talk about those four main areas of outdoor education, the fitness training, the expeditions, projects which are to do with craft, and actually the rescue service section, it sounds really sort of similar conceptually to what we do with outdoor education today. But obviously, there's been quite a big move forward and change, as there has with everything. Can you tell us a little bit more in more depth about how outdoor education looks today?
Yeah, of course. It's quite interesting. Ross, just going back to Pete Allison, he actually lectured me at university. So there you are.
There you go.
At my house. Awesome. And he was the first person that actually also gave me really explained the simple concept of recreation, where we go to the countryside to recreate ourselves, which was so outdoor recreation was that concept. And I can still remember that lecture vividly today about the purpose of recreation. Obviously amazing. Not quite linked to what we're doing, but interesting. So yeah, what's it evolved into? Well, I suppose lots of parts of the modern curriculum try to establish and buy into lots of what Kurt Hahn says. So obviously games and PE exist and take a lot of that fitness training. Projects exist, and lots of schools run projects, charity projects or chapel projects or supporting local community centres, whatever projects. So all those things exist. The rescue service is quite an interesting concept, and maybe schools find those harder to do, and expeditions exist. But to me, it's changed a lot, and we do a lot more small-scale outdoor learning in schools today, where we look to take kids outside and opportunities to expand their horizons beyond the classroom, but not in such a prescriptive way as he suggests, and maybe not with such a level of challenge or purpose as we suggest. And we can come to that and explore whether they should be challenging and purposeful later. most schools in the UK find that school residential plays the key role in providing this principle. And there's lots of providers across the UK. So PGL and Outward Bound, as you mentioned earlier, are two of the big ones. And schools will go off often year six at the end of primary school, go off to do their week-long residential where they have to have a go at all these activities. For schools to provide meaningful outdoor education has become really, really challenging in my eyes. You need staff that are both competent and experienced. And then to prove that competence, you've either got to have qualifications in the activities you want to provide, or you've got to be extremely experienced that you feel like you're confident enough to take pupils outside, forge that time in the curriculum, sort of knock on the right doors of the right leadership member who's going to let you in and give you that space and to make those big expeditions, those big adventures happen. However, we have seen this sort of emergence of forest school, which has been a real, real delight to see, especially in nursery levels and preschool education, and a huge amount of training for practitioners in these environments, which is really taking the lead in getting younger children outdoors. And that's really exciting. And it'd be interesting to see go forward this sort of whole forest school generation coming up through the school and whether they look any or feel any different to my daughter, who's at a 5-day a week indoor nursery. So I can't stand here and say that I'm fully behind it, but it's cold and wet in Scotland occasionally. But it'd be really interesting to see how these sort of principles change and whether they have this any change in the pupils that come through who've had this sort of forest school.
Yeah, I mean, I think anecdotally, the school that and the nursery that my children have been to have outdoor ed, and they have a specialist teacher to do so. And we're very lucky, and I'm aware of that. We're a family that enjoys the outdoors and nature as well, but I certainly can tell from what my daughter says that she recognises a lot of different leaves, different berries. She's really aware of fire safety. So latently, there are skills which are going in and an appreciation of the world around her that probably wouldn't be there if she didn't have those lessons at school, which they take, I suppose, what the teacher says more seriously than what a kind of yapping little mother does. And in fact, I asked her today what she liked about outdoor ed, because it's one of her favourite lessons on the timetable. And she said to me that she enjoys just being in nature. She's seen some little wild animals, which she's enjoyed. And I asked her why she enjoyed being in nature. And she told me it made her feel happy. I think that is such an amazing thing that a lesson can offer somebody. It's taking away pressure. It's enabling a child to flourish in a different area. And that's certainly what I saw on a more extravagant scale when I did a bushcraft residential week with a group of non-selectively academic 8-year-olds and a boy who had historically always struggled in the classroom with his attention, with his academic capabilities in maths and English. That boy shone during that week away, and you could see him just start to grow physically, you know, literally in front of you and metaphorically in his confidence and his presence by feeling valued by being outside and finding something he was really into. So it's such a valuable lesson, I think.
So I've obviously, you know, I recognise that we're all privileged to different degrees in terms of our own experience with the outdoors and the environments we work in and how we deliver outdoor education. But then if you take a step back and think about the picture across the UK, globally, how accessible is it? And, you know, is it for all ages? Is it for all incomes? And then just as you were speaking there, Isabel, as well, and this is really a question for Tom, different abilities, because if you've got a group and you're out doing whatever it is, really, it doesn't really matter what it is, I suppose, and they've all got different experience levels already, how do you make it meaningful and worthwhile and something they can all achieve at, and I guess how do you meet the lesson objective, or well, not lesson objective, the objective of the exercise?
Big question. We run a program at school where all the year 9 pupils come in and they have to do a 4 days of outdoor education across the year, which I sort of fought hard to get into the timetable. And they complete a day's conservation work. They climb a Munro, so a mountain over 3,000 feet in Scotland. They go canoeing on a loch and they go rock climbing outdoors. We just had our first one last week. And those days are specifically designed that every activity, and I've spoken to all the staff that lead them, that there is that element that everyone can have a sense of achievement. So there was a girl last week who getting off the ground was a proper achievement. Rock climbing 2 meters was a fantastic, but she loved belaying. She was super, super competent at her rope work. Everyone trusted her, wanted her to be the belayer. So that sense of fulfillment was seen, but it was her fulfillment was just like, you know what? I'm never going to be into rock climbing. I don't get it. I don't understand the point in just climbing up this rock face, but I do understand the element of keeping somebody safe and looking after a friend. And that trust and seeing certain boys ask this girl to belay them that you'd never see because they trusted her was a real powerful moment, which we couldn't have created in the classroom. And it was really, really good to see. Similarly, there was a girl who last year tried to climb Munro and didn't actually make it to the top. And then this year did climb the Munro and make it to the top. So by providing the opportunities, the support network, the focus and the from both staff, pupils, and an understanding that everybody's going to get something different out of the day. And some of you might be learning to navigate. Some of you might just be focusing on like actually achievement for me is scaling this mountain. You need practitioners that can create those challenges to make a full day of one activity really interesting. And going back to sort of fit all ages or all incomes and our fortune, I suppose what we get is that there's the residential centres provide so much of the traditional outdoor education that it becomes quite, in my eyes, it becomes quite light touch that you get, they go off, they do 4 different activities in the day and they quickly get upside down a tower and that takes about a minute or 2 minutes and then they'll probably wait an hour to their next activity and they get to do a little bit of archery. And this I worked in the centre, I've been through centre work, I've done it and I reflect on it and it's like, actually, what's far more valuable in that sense is actually what I believe a school can do on site, wherever they are, which is the lighting the fires you spoke about earlier, Isabel, or developing basic orienteering schools around town. And I said to Ross earlier this year when we were out doing some work for another school, one of the best things you could ever do, make a kid do to encourage teamwork is put up a tent. Like, it's a fantastic activity for getting 2 or 3 people who don't know each other together and spending 30 minutes, because putting up a tent, if you've never done it before or you're working with someone new, can be a very, very stressful experience. And you can learn a lot about how someone like me operates, which would be like, right, let's just go on with this. And somebody who's far more structured operates, who'd think about, like, no, the instructions are definitely required. And then you can develop it. So I think for so long we've painted outdoor education as rock climbing and canoeing, and I love that. We need to look at what the purpose of those two activities, if they can't be provided in the right structure to maximise the benefit for the pupils, but actually to think about what other meaningful small-scale activities can get pupils outside to learn, to be with other people, to experience nature and to challenge themselves. And I think the range of that is huge. And a quick Google search for outdoor learning activities now provides this plethora of opportunities. And I'd encourage every teacher just to have a quick look for their subject. If you just go outdoor learning, chemistry, outdoor learning, English, you will find a range of activities that you can take your class in a 55, 30 minute, 45 minute lesson to complete. And I think that's where the real opportunity for growth is. I think that the classic outdoor education model is a real expensive challenge for schools. And in Scotland now, we've got a policy, or hopefully going to have a policy, that all pupils must go on a residential trip. But the cost of this to families, the cost of this to who's going to pay for it, and the cost of making sure that those experiences, apart from going away from their parents for 4 nights, it's a fantastic experience for any child at the age of 13. And it doesn't necessarily mean that if they don't canoe or they don't, it's not valuable. But making sure the experiences they get on those trips are both meaningful and purposeful, as you mentioned earlier, is a real challenge. So it's quite a hard thing to consider. And that's why the term outdoor learning, I prefer much prefer to outdoor education, is because it's all encompassing. It allows schools a far wider framework for what they want to do.
I agree with you. And actually, having been around various schools, I've seen some really good examples of where outdoor learning happens, but as you say, not on a grand and expensive scale. You know, small garden plots are a brilliant place to start. You know, getting the children to cultivate some vegetables which have been grown that can then be cooked in the school kitchen. Or I've seen, actually it was on television, a school in Spain that was a really urban school, and it just required some imagination and some commitment from the teaching staff, that they did loads of pot plants and stuff that the children all looked after outside. Now this is clearly a far cry away from going rock climbing, but is it any less valuable? Probably not. You know, having an on-site guinea pig would be a good place to start. It doesn't need to cost a great deal. And in fact, in some ways, I think these opportunities that are more quotidian, that are low key, that can be done all the time, are brilliant. One other sort of example I've seen that really didn't cost very much at all. They had a beautiful site, don't get me wrong, but this is not a fancy private school. It's for children with special educational needs. They're working on a tight budget. And the kitchen garden, which was run by somebody locally, was phenomenal to get these children with severe and complex learning needs outside, helping, seeing how produce grows, learning so much from being outside was just really very special to see.
So I, on the kitchen garden front, I was at a SCIS outdoor learning conference earlier this week in Edinburgh, and the school that hosted it, it was just amazing what they were doing. And you know, you're talking about outdoor learning costing. Well, in this case, actually, it made the school money. And, you know, it had very little by the way of seed fund, you know, but what I mean by that is, as you say, you know, finding a patch of ground, literally just a scrap of ground somewhere to grow something, but it has to then be something that the children or the families want at the end of the day. And so they were literally making their own apple juice and selling cups of apple juice on the gate at the end of the day. And, you know, that's £40 a week. And that's £40 a week they could reinvest into their little gardening scheme. So, you know, it doesn't need to be on a huge scale. But what was really exciting, I thought, by their whole, they called it the farm project, was how integrated it was. So, you know, they showed me the schemes of work they had, all of the curriculum of excellence, lesson objectives were in there from various subjects, math, science, etc. And I think it augments an existing curriculum and actually can completely replace some lessons, and that lesson can be done outside. And then one sort of final thought on that was quite interesting was, you know, schools have funds for certain capital projects that could be, you know, to build a classroom, a porter cabin, whatever it is. A polytunnel, which you might use for half the year, will be the cheapest outdoor classroom you'll ever buy. You know, you can get a polytunnel of a huge scale, three times the size of a normal classroom, for £5,000. And this particular school did that. And they then taught lessons out, you know, for the other half of the year that they weren't using the polytunnel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's trying to think differently about your space, I think.
Now, let's try and be the devil's advocate here. Can we ever have too much outdoor learning? Surely the answer is
absolutely.
No.
Well, so I suppose I can speak from a little bit of position of experience. I was a head of department. I was responsible for GCSE and A-level results. I was getting the pressure from senior management team to make sure that my value added was up there and my data was good, and I had to make sure that all these outcomes were there. So I think absolutely. And like, we've all had those frustrations as a teacher when pupils are out of lessons and missing lessons and what's the point in what they're doing. So I think that, yeah, it's all education is a balance, and a rounded education should involve a bit of outdoors and a bit of sports and a bit of music and a bit of drama and hopefully some really good, meaningful lessons. And then the opportunity for the pupils who find their passions and the opportunities to excel in those. But I think for me, if it's poorly planned or it's not within a wider experience, or not within a wider curriculum, and it's just seen as an experience rather than genuine learning, it becomes just a day out. And we do have day outs at school. We have day outs where we take kids off to do things, and they can sign up for them and they can have them enjoyable day outs and trips. And then you've got to make sure that what they're doing on these days, if you want to make senior management aware of it and those parents feel like it's purposeful and meaningful, you have to make sure that it fits into some sort of educational philosophy at Mountain School, that it supports tangibly what they're doing in other lessons, that it can, that you're not, we had Bruce Robertson talk to us about INSET and earlier this year, who's came to do our INSET about powering up our pedagogy. And the first thing he said is that if you're just doing something for fun, is it meaningful or is it purposeful? Is it activity in the classroom or in education? It's like, if the reason you're doing it is for fun, perhaps you need to question why you're doing it. And that hit me like, oh God, make sure what I'm doing at school isn't just fun. Like if I'm selling this thing as fun, then, and a couple of parents have called me the head of fun. I was like, actually, no, it's not. It's really important what we do, but it supports the learning that pupils are doing. It doesn't replace, and it can't, in my eyes, it's not, I'm never going to teach a lesson on population pyramids or structures as effectively outside as I would do when we're actually studying population change within countries and people are looking at graphs and stuff inside and the focus is on the table. Like, that's a lesson that needs to be, they need to be that full focus. So yes, I totally believe you can't have too much outdoor learning. As always, a balance is super important.
We believe it's valuable. And, you know, we wouldn't be having this conversation otherwise. But is there any actual research that suggests that it adds value? I don't know whether that it needs to be academic or not.
So if you actually look up the Curriculum for Excellence, which you mentioned earlier, they have a big document, which is called the Curriculum for Excellence Through Outdoor Learning. It was designed when the Curriculum for Excellence was integrated in Scotland about 12 years ago. And it sets out this sort of progressive approach to what all learners should get wherever you are in Scotland. And it talks about the objectives, so making kids smarter, healthier, safer, stronger, greener, wealthier and fairer. And those are their objectives that they've set for it. And it sets out a huge rationale for why they believe it. It took sort of elements of the Swedish and Finnish models of schooling and thought about how those could be integrated, and it dictates that they need to be progressive, etc. throughout. So I think, although it's not a piece of research, it's a definite sort of signpost for anyone who's thinking about what you want outdoor learning to look like, and why it's important. It provides quite a lot of structure to what I do as a job, I don't use it daily, but I definitely use it occasionally to back up some of what I do. And I know that there's people who go off and do outdoor education degrees before they take on a job like mine. And there's a huge host of research out there. The research needs to be like any educational research. You'll always find a piece of research that's a great idea. You'll always find a piece of research that's a terrible idea. And I think it has to be so place-based specific. So like, actually, what the intentions for outdoor learning do you want to get out of the learners in your school? Because not every school can operate and do the things that we do as a school because of our site, our location, our staffing, and the commitment from the team above me who want to see this happen. Whereas actually you might not have that, but you need therefore to make the appropriate decisions for your location. And that's where I think sometimes if you underpin it all too much through research rather than thinking actually what's right and best for our pupils, if we accept that doing stuff outdoors is good, then that's where I think schools need to focus on, is that don't get caught up in this trap that there's a certain view of what it must look like.
Yeah, that was my sort of overarching feedback at this SCIS conference earlier in the week, that essentially their program was, the host school, their program was amazing. And I witnessed the children actually benefiting from it whilst I was there. It was absolutely remarkable, but it was driven by the personalities that they happened to have on the staff at the time, and they then recognized that. So it's, you know, it's what's appropriate and what's achievable for each different school. And I think your point earlier, Tom, about competence and skill set and your environment, you know, we're very fortunate, the school that we both work at the moment, we have an environment which lends itself to that. The school that Isabel and I both worked at did not.
No.
But, you know, how I guess it's how you use what you have. And actually, as well, at that school, we had chickens on the side of the tube embankment, and we had bees on the roof. And, you know, we did.
I mean, you know, yes, that's because you were heroic at introducing outdoor learning into a school environment.
Away from Miss Marani. I can't.
Yeah. Well, anyway, in a very urban school with, relatively speaking, very little outdoor space, Ross, you were phenomenally successful at introducing outdoor learning to them via the dear old chickens and your expeditions and all sorts of other bits and bobs.
The legacy is really important. So while we were there, obviously, you know, Ellen Kirby then took up the mantle, and you know, it's still going. So I'm actually going to be back at that school this coming week. So, you know, they still do a lot of those things. And I think that's another thing. You know, it can't be too reliant on personalities. And I guess I was keenly aware of that at the time.
Well, it's just to put the systems in place. It's a bit like that school I was telling you about that was very urban in Spain, where they got loads of sort of pot plants and little flowers all in this incredibly urban little playground. But somebody had had the imagination and creativity and impetus to get it going. And once something started, it's quite easy to continue it, really. So, yes. So it's a combination of things, isn't it? It's having the right site that makes it really ideal. But equally, it's about someone with some motivation and inspiration to do something with what they've got.
Yeah, I think that's really well put. Going back to that question, Tom, about, you know, is there actually any research? You know, there's stacks, and in a way, there's too much to mention. And your point about having research which is relevant, I found two pieces which I think are probably worth mentioning tonight, and that's one piece which is heavily lent on by the government in England, and that was a piece done in 2016 by Natural Connections Demonstration in the southwest of England, actually, probably in schools that you guys know well. 40,000 primary and secondary school pupils and their teachers were involved in this sort of macro piece of research. And it was really a bit like what you said your child was saying to you, Isabel. It was all about how they felt having experienced outdoor education. And so, you know, some pretty amazing stats from that. 95% of children surveyed said outdoor learning made lessons more enjoyable. And, you know, if for no other reason, I guess that's going to improve engagement, isn't it? And which will trickle down to outcome. So, you know, you've got in lots of schools where behavior is an issue, 85% of schools saw a positive impact on behavior. 90% of staff found that outdoor learning was useful for curriculum delivery. And 72% of schools reported that outdoor learning had a positive impact on teachers' health and well-being. And I think that's something we haven't discussed, but it's sort of at the forefront of my mind. Why do people come to schools like ours, Tom? Why did we come? Part of it is for the outdoor learning. And it's because we benefit by it as well as the pupils.
Yeah, so I'm very fortunate. I've got a number of staff who are super keen. So I kind of run my own little department in terms of I'm not a one-man band. I definitely am very fortunate. And I've got staff that are far more skilled in terms of qualification based than I am. So we've got mountaineering climbing instructors. We've got paddle sport instructors. We've got mountain biking leaders on the team. And then a range of mountain leaders. And just sort of to give some context to people, so which is both terrifying but also empowering, is that to become a mountain leader, it takes about 100 days of your time to effectively go through the training process for that. And then if you wanted to be a winter mountain leader, that's another 100 days on top. The rock climbing instructor is probably about another 100 days on top. These things are extremely, like, these are challenging. This is where a challenge for a teacher to deliver that traditional outdoor education is really hard, because either you've then got to buy in the expertise, and that comes at real cost to budgets and parents, etc. So schools that can attract those staff are really lucky, and we have a sort of CPD. I try to train staff, I try to motivate staff to go off and do courses and qualifications, etc. I'm lucky that my sort of senior team support that. But I think that's where the narrative is changing, and why we've discussed so much about that narrative changing, is that although I love the program that I'm creating, I'm very aware that the program I'm creating is not naturally like applicable nationally to the same extent, and training teachers to have the confidence to take their children outside the school gates and to the beach or to the park or to the forest or to get those confidence levels up amongst staff is in my eyes is a far more bang for your buck in a sense. Like, you're going to get far more better value for money out of it than trying to, and the teachers who are naturally inspired to go off and do their mountain walks will go off and do them anyway, because that's they get that personal passion.
I totally agree with what you're saying, Tom, and actually we almost want people to take away from this that if you have any vague interest or thought that you would like to increase the amount of outdoor learning that's in your school, it needn't be an intimidating process. It doesn't need to be rock climbing and canoeing. It can be thinking of something constructive to do in the park, like getting some leaves and creating some art with it when you get back home, and having identified different leaves from trees or something. It doesn't need to be something extravagant. And I guess what would be great to put in the notes, if we can, when we air this episode, this podcast shows my age, would be maybe a couple of websites. You mentioned one that might be available that gives teachers ideas of lessons that can be done outside for maths or English or geography. And it might be that teachers just start dipping into those a little bit more than perhaps they would have done ordinarily. And that's just converted a few more people into doing more outdoors.
Yeah, I mean, we can totally put everything we mention into the episode notes. I know from previous episodes we get a lot of use from those notes, and people are very grateful. They're very good at sort of emailing in to thank us for signposting things. So and likewise, if someone is listening to this and they think, right, I've got this amazing resource, you haven't mentioned it on your podcast episode, can you add it to your notes? I'm very happy to do that as well. So if anyone's listening, obviously our email address is therestiseducation@gmail.com, and I'll read that the same day, and everything is gratefully received.
Yeah, the top one I'll just identify straight away is Learning Through Landscapes. Learning Through Landscapes is a cracking website that has, you go down the list of subjects. So it's got art, design, drama, geography, history, literacy, physical education, religious education, math, science, technology. It has resources for all subjects.
While we're plugging things just quickly, one, I think, amazing resource that not all schools are utilizing. Certainly, it's not as well known as I think it should be. The Field Studies Council. I can absolutely rate those guys, and I actually support them financially with one of the things that they do, their Young Darwin Scholarship. And I think, you know, if anyone is in a school at the moment and they think we could be doing outdoor ed better, but I'm not really quite sure how to do it, have a look at the Field Studies Council site. It's just an absolute plethora of different things in terms of like resources you can use in your school, but also their sites that you can go and visit, residential buildings, staff whose expertise you can lean upon, and it's all very affordable and aimed at really increasing participation in the outdoors. So yeah, Field Studies Council. Tom, I mentioned two bits of research. We haven't talked about benefits on attainment, and I know that might seem obvious. If people are more engaged, they're going to do better. But I came across a piece of research used by Harvard University in 2022 by the North American Association for Environmental Action. And it claims that being outside for as little as 5 minutes a day will improve attainment outcomes. And this sparked a USA and Canada wide campaign called Outside for Five, which is pretty well known in schools on that side of the Atlantic. So, that's obviously a bit of research I can put in the notes. People can read that. But, there are clearly benefits to attainment as well as well-being. So I suppose we should be thinking about wrapping up. Tom, what got you into the outdoors in the first place?
So at school, I was lucky. We had a massive event in the West Country called the 10 Tours event. 10 Tours is a sort of trek across Dartmoor, and you complete this as a team. And I suppose it comes from the sort of side of it, which I'm trying to always wean myself off, is that it was a challenge, and it was there was a bit of like, you had to be self-supported and there was a bit of resilience and it was that expedition focus to it. But that gave me a real buzz. And then I suppose I was lucky that my parents were always taking me out riding my bike, and my dad would take me off on hill walks, etc. And I definitely went through that teenage phase when hill walking was not cool to be out with my dad hill walking. But then I definitely came out of it pretty quickly and realised that actually, like, going out in the hills on a Saturday or Sunday gave me a real positive, gave me an escape, and gave me balance. I was a sportsman as well, so I played rugby and hockey the whole way through. Never just been an outdoorsy sort of person. And then what's sort of almost fulfilled it for the future, and I think this is one thing I haven't talked about yet, and I will leave you with, is that I know lots of people who rock climb and kayak into their 70s and 80s. And I don't know many people who play rugby into their 70s and 80s. And I think this is really valuable in terms of the health and well-being, that it really is lifelong, these activities that we're teaching people. And yeah, and if that becomes lifelong in terms of actually gardening or just reading your book outside rather than sitting on your chair to take yourself away from your distractions and TV, I mean, these are really valuable lessons that we can teach everybody, children and adults, that that sort of vitamin D hit and the space and the benefits of nature are so rewarding that it's really important to make space for it in our lives.
I think what you say is just, it's so true for you personally, because like you live it, you know, you seem like the Duracell bunny when I see you walking around the quad, you know, you are the most active person. And clearly like the benefits are real for you day to day, as they are for other colleagues who are a bit older than you and I, who we can think of. You're absolutely right. It's like lifelong learning to the max, really. Isabel, what sparked it for you?
Oh, I think it's always been deep within. I had a very outdoorsy childhood. I grew up in the middle of Wales, so I was continually like wandering around fields and in small rivers, fiddling around, doing stuff, not sure what. I'm not a particularly traditionally sporty person. I did obviously have to play sports at school, but it wasn't where I felt comfortable. But I've always loved being outside. And I think for me, it's probably more to do with the mental mindfulness of the nature and the outdoors. For me, I suppose I'm someone that races around doing 50 million things all day long. And I find going outside for a 20-minute walk calms me, because the pace of life is slower out in the nature. And I feel more relaxed. And I'm certainly, I follow various sort of health podcasts, and there's been lots of chat amongst the ladies who deliver these things about the fact that morning light is very good for you. It's good for your circadian rhythm. It's good for your sense of peace and happiness. And I really can feel it. I've been trying to poke my little nose out at something in the early 60s to look at the dawn coming, and I find it really enlightening. So I am not your traditional let's go and hike up a hill, sweating profusely and challenging myself and sort of rock climbing. I'm a more gentle enjoyer of the outdoor nature.
But you know, from what you've just said there, I guarantee that you will always enjoy it.
Oh, yes. I'm going to be like gardening when I'm 85 for sure, unless something really prevents me from doing so. And Ross, we must ask you about you as well. How did you become so unbelievably enthusiastic about the outdoor world?
So I guess being reflective, I'm not the stereotypical outdoorsy person, or I wasn't as a child. I was dragged around every castle in Northumberland on weekends. Probably too much history, and that maybe is what led me down the sort of history route. In terms of like an appreciation for the outdoors and a real love for it, the pinnacle moment for me was the primary school residential trip. And, you know, we touched upon the fact that we're fortunate to have gone on things like that at a crucial age. And I remember there were boys and girls who did not get on the minibus, you know, their parents couldn't afford it. And I'm so so grateful to my parents for making that trip happen. We went to Broomley Grange in Northumberland, still working as a it's still a residential sort of centre, independently run charitable trust. And you know, you can go there and probably experience exactly what I experienced some time ago. And I just remember having the best week, you know, just literally out with your classmates in the outdoors, learning stuff, a bit like field study council type of experience, I suppose. So learning actual things, but also having the high octane stuff as well, you know, doing the orienteering, doing the archery, doing the abseiling. That for me was just like a key in the lock, you know. And Isabel, I've found as well your neck of the woods to be quite or where you grew up to be quite a sort of important place, and in that I've turned to the outdoors at difficult times in my life. And I remember I had a very big decision to make some time ago, and a friend and I went to Offa's Dyke, walked down the border of Wales, you know, and just had time in nature to think about what was important, free from the distractions that Kurt Hahn references. And, you know, we arrived in Chepstow a week or so later. I still didn't have any trousers and, you know, mild symptoms of hypothermia. But I'd made a decision and I went down that route in life. And, you know, I think, had I not had a passion for the outdoors, or maybe the confidence to be able to, you know, you talk about competence as well, Tom, to like navigate and survive and enjoy the outdoors, then, you know, life would have been very different, because I probably wouldn't have benefited from moments like that. So, yeah, I think the outdoors, it's an important educational tool, but I think also for us as humans, it can be a bit of a haven if you're not frightened of it. And I suppose it's getting people to learn and to appreciate at an early age would be my personal view.
Nice.
Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the episode tonight. I think probably I'm going to go out on the limb and say most enjoyable episode.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
Tom, enjoy the rest of the climbing course.
Yeah, one more day. So the rain's coming tomorrow, so it'll be lots of working with ropes rather than actual climbing, but hey-ho.
And Isabel, great to have you back on. You've been listening to The Rest is Education. If you'd like to get in touch, please do so. We are on LinkedIn, we're on Instagram, we are on Gmail, and it's therestiseducation@gmail.com. Thanks very much.